We want to welcome back Tom Beatty. He's been sick for a long time, and we're just delighted that he can be back today. And he's a longtime friend of our speaker today. He's going to do the introduction for us. We'll just get started quick as we can to give Mac all the time he needs.
I'm very glad to be back and want to thank all of you for your expressions of concern and especially your prayers. They work. Yesterday before Mac and Marty arrived, Bonnie and I were trying to remember when and under what circumstances we got to know them. Well, after they got there, we figured out it was 27 years ago when he was moving from teaching at Harding Graduate School in Memphis to Nashville to teach at Lipscomb. So we established that connection, and although we haven't had a lot of contact since then, we have kept in touch with his and Marty's work and mission work. Marty is the Chancellor of Nations University, which may not be on the tip of your tongues, but Nations University is an internet educational tool for continuing education programs designed specifically for use in mission fields. As you can imagine, missionaries away from home for a number of years would like to continue their education for themselves and their families, and also the converts that they make are interested in continuing education. So this, a few years ago, Mac and Dick Eddy, whom many of you recognize from WEI, decided to start this internet university. Of course, this is operated from Nashville, and they don't have to get away from home to do that. But they are not retirees, Mac and Marty. Not only do they furnish this tool and also help utilize the WEI and World Bible School tools to help missionaries, they travel to the mission fields in order to assist the missionaries. So they, I believe the last count was about 40 countries around the world that they have worked with mission efforts. So I learned one secret last night. Marty's the brains, Mac does the talking, so I'll let him talk. Welcome to Marvin.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with our old friends, and we have learned that we had other connections when we went to the Bird's house last evening. And Dick Ade and I were in school together many years ago, and I met Tom Langley. Is Tom here today? I met Tom in Romania some years ago. So we do have some connections with Maryville, and we're grateful for that. You've come today to be exposed to his lamb. How many of you know anything at all about Islam? Okay. So how many of you know almost nothing about Islam? Well, fair. Okay, good. How many of you are experts? I'm always afraid of the experts because, you know, sometimes you can make a statement and somebody else has been there and they know differently. How many of you have ever lived in a country that is controlled by Muslims? We have five. How many of you visited a Muslim country? You at least know where that is. So most of you are kind of homebodies, right? All right, it is very important. First of all, let me lay out what we're going to do today so you know where we're going and then when we get there, where we've been. Number one, during the class period, we're going to give a brief overview of the central tenets of Islam, all right? And in the sermon, we're going to show something of the nature of Christianity versus Islam, but we're going to do it in a positive way and make some reference to Islam, but not specifically talk about Islam in the sermon time. But we're going to confirm our own faith and show why there is the tension and the conflict between the two. And then this evening, what our plan is to bring us up to date in terms of the various divisions we call diversity within Islam, because Islam is like Christianity. You just stop and think about that for a moment. You got Roman Catholicism and the Orthodox groups. You have the Protestant groups, Evangelicals, Pentecostals, Mormons, and Seventh-day Adventists, and you just keep on going. So we know from the Christian side of the fence that there is a lot of diversity. And when you try to describe one religious denomination, it doesn't always fit another one, right? And so here in Islam, when we see something, hear something, or want to visualize how Islam is, we might just pick on one little group or one little school of thought and think that that represents the whole Islamic field. But there's a great deal of diversity, and tonight we're going to look at that. And we're not going to get so much into politics tonight, but we will see why the situation in the Middle East is so tense and, should I say, impossible. All right, Islam. Let's see what we can do about this subject. First of all, the word Islam, you see, there are three little letters, S, L, and M. See that? That Islam has three consonants. Now, you look at the next word, Muslim, it has the same three consonants, although M-U is in front of it. Now, in Arabic, to name a person is to put an M-U in front of it, or an airport or something like that. We don't do that in English, but that's the reason there's a confusion between Muslim and Islam. The radicals are the same, but it's the adding of the person. The one who belongs or who subscribes to Islam is a Muslim. Or if you're going to use the word peace, and you often hear the word peace associated, salam, it's still got those three little letters in the radical. So they're all from the same place, and we find a lot of times the use of this word in the Arabic language. And if it looks like I'm not looking at you, I'm looking at the back wall over there to see just where we are. So this word in Arabic has a lot of different meanings. It comes out differently. But the big question that faces us is how do we decide what is Islamic when there are no Quranic Muslims? Now, obviously, I've got to explain that. Quran is the sacred book. Those are the scriptures, the recitations of Muhammad. That's the basis of it all, but that's not the whole story. You've got to have a way of interpreting the Quran, and those are the sayings or the hadith, the sayings of Muhammad. And then in some sections, in the Sunni section of Islam, there is the addition of the consensus and analogy, and then there are schools of thought, which we will get to. So it is a question, you know, we say, well, that's not Islamic. That is not true to Islam. The question is, how do you define Islam or what a Muslim is when there are no Quranic Muslims? In other words, there's no Bible only, Quran only interpretation in Islam. Now, we like to think that we are Bible only, not realizing we are influenced by history and by other individuals who've come down the road, but at least the claim there, if you want to know a real Christian, then you find the Bible is the ideal that's there. Well, the Quran may be an ideal, but it's not the end of the road, as we like to think. So how to define one who is or is not a Muslim? Therefore, when you hear somebody say, well, that is not a Muslim, when you're talking about extremism, that is not Muslim thought, just put a little question mark there, and we'll see how difficult answering that question is. If we were to answer the question, if we go by the Quran, what does a Muslim look like? Well, we wouldn't find any today, because there are none who say, I am a Muslim only because I follow the Quran. So, since there are none, you can't really use that. Do you use the hadith? Well, that's the traditions, the sayings of Muhammad, which would be the interpretation of the Islam. Well, okay, if you're a Sunni or a Shia, which hadith is the question that were there? Are you using a Shiite view? If you are, you're representing only about 15% of all the Muslims in the world. Are you using one of the major schools of interpretation? And we're going to learn that there are four of these major schools. Some of them are more literal than others. ISIS is more of the literal type. Do you say, well, ISIS is not true Islamic? Why do they call themselves the Islamic State? And you can trace the extremism through the literal adaptation of one of the schools, the same school of thought that you find in Saudi Arabia? Or do you use your neighbor as the definition of a Muslim? And let me pause just a moment here, because it's very important that I get your attention. Not that I don't have it, but I want to keep it. Whenever you open the subject of Islam, you meet at least three, hopefully four, but at least three different attitudes. One, the person is knowledgeable enough to be afraid to jump at conclusions and become radicalized on the anti-Muslim point of view. I'm just trying to paint this to say that sometimes people get so excited about it that they will go beyond perhaps where they ought to be in their enthusiasm. On the other side, there are the individuals who are good Americans, reared in a younger generation, in another age, who are tolerant of everything and don't want anybody to judge anybody. I mean, let them alone, they're okay, they're not what you say that they are. And so you got on one side the response to the other side, and one wonders where it is. There's a middle group who says, I don't know anything about it, and I don't want to know anything about it. What you don't know doesn't hurt you. And hopefully there is a fourth group, and you will be in this fourth group, that as we move today, you will say, okay, I understand something about it, maybe not an expert in it, but understand enough to know why it is in conflict with Christianity and why there should be some concern, and thus you become an informed person who is able to react in a good, Christian, honest way. Now, that's really what we're aiming for. Okay, so now we get down to the central tenet. What really lies at the center of Islam? I know we hear a lot of things. We hear it on the news, we hear it from our friends and neighbors, schoolrooms, etc. But what is at the center of it? Now, oftentimes when the subject of Islam is brought up, somebody says, okay, there are five pillars. And that's true, there are five pillars. Usually when I say there are five, I can remember four of them. If I say there are six things, I can remember five. But the Hajj that we have just finished over in Saudi Arabia, you know, where the crash of the crane killed over 100 people. The Hajj, where you go once a lifetime, hopefully, if you can, that's one of the pillars. Another would be fasting at Ramadan, a month of fasting during the daytime and eating at night, but fasting in the daylight hours. Another would be the prayers that are offered by good Muslims, especially offered on a Friday, but they may be offered all the time, five times a day, three times in the Shiite area. There would be the almsgiving, giving of a certain percent of what you hold in order to relieve the poor, and then there is a fifth one. Okay, so sometimes... Sometimes you start out with five pillars. The fifth one is the confession. I believe in one God, Allah, and that Muhammad is his prophet. And that is really what makes one a Muslim, is subscription to that. But we start out with five pillars, and what we have in our mind is there are five things they do. Sort of like saying in Christianity, we have singing and praying and the Lord's Supper. See, we kind of do the same thing. It's describing who we are, but it doesn't touch the centrality. Because within the Christianity, the centrality is the death, burial, resurrection, ascension, and coronation of Jesus, and the salvation that comes to us by grace through faith. So that gets at the centrality. Man is the center, etc. And that's what we're going to do more in the sermon time. But what is the center item within Islam? Well, it's the word tawheed, which is an Arabic word which can be translated oneness, unity, singular, unique. Let's just choose the first one, oneness. Oneness. Now, what do you mean by oneness? Well, this oneness is the realization and the affirmation of the unity of Allah, of a divine unity, which also includes the unity of the universe. Now, let me see if I can just sort of put it together here. If there is one God, Allah, Allah has then created the world. Allah has given his will to the world. Man has corrupted the will. Jews corrupted it. Christians corrupted it. For example, Christians corrupted it when they said that Jesus is the Son of God, He was resurrected from the dead, or even died on a cross. So Christians and Jews have both corrupted the revelations, plural, of Allah. But what He gave to Muhammad was the last, the final, because he is the last prophet. And therefore, what is in the Quran, the recitations and the hadith, would be from Allah. And that then is the revelation, which tells us that Allah created the world, that there is no associate with Allah, and that everything holds together. And as long as the world observes the Sharia, which is the totality of the Islamic law, then everything will be fine. When there is an earthquake, somebody has upset Allah, and Allah is sending a message. When there is a difficulty within one's life, then he looks and reflects in a sort of a cause and effect relationship, as well as a predetermined kind of, it depends upon which, where you are in Islam on this, to what extent it's predetermined. But there is the connection between the ordering of the universe and peace with Allah. Now, if that is the centrality of Islam, then you can understand why the Muslim would feel that if the West or the non-Muslim or the Jew or the communist or anybody else is not following the will of Allah, is not a Muslim, that Allah is unpleased, and that certain bad things are going to happen to the Muslims because they haven't done their job. I would imagine, I've never heard one express it, but I would imagine the war in the Middle East is the most embarrassing thing. I mean, it has to be for the Muslim a holocaust. For them to have the ideal of the oneness and everything is going well, but they're fighting among themselves. How can they live with that, given the principal doctrine? But we're not talking about realities so much as we're talking about ideals in this session. So the ideal of the unity of Allah is, that's a key point. Everything else will be thrown away. You can throw away all of the five pillars and everything else. You've got to come in strong at the Tawheed, the oneness, because it's going to define theology and it's going to define politics, it's going to define behavior. There are these categories in Tawheed. Without a partner, Allah, the word for God, simply is a word for God in Arabic, that He is without a partner in His dominion and His actions. Now, what that means is, there can be no Jesus, the Son of God. There's Jesus, the prophet. Jesus was a great teacher, true to God, but that was it. When you began to associate Jesus with God in any unique way, not allowed. Because Allah has no partner, either in creation or in the work that He does. He is one. There's the oneness. He is alone. He is without similitude in His essence and attributes. You cannot describe Him. We often say God held His ear and heard His people, or He smelled evil, or He walked in the garden, or using human attributes to describe God. Not allowed. That's why there are no pictures allowed. There are no images allowed in Islam. Even though they do have the Kaaba and a few other things, they don't count. But God cannot be described in human terms. He is without rival in His divinity and worship. So it's not a dualism where there's Satan and Allah, we don't know just how it's going to come out, because Allah is one and only. So He is held on a very high pedestal. And we're not knocking that, but we are denying that He can have, we are affirming that He can have partner. Other words, you've got Allah who in the Muslim mind can do anything. And even in a Muslim country, you might find some Muslims say, all things are possible. And you want to say, can God have a son? See, not all things are possible in Islam. So it is very limiting when it comes to what God can do and has done, will do, relationship to others. He cannot have a relationship with humanity. like in Christianity, we talk about a relationship we have with God. You don't have a relationship, nothing of the kind that we speak of. There are 99 names for Allah in the Quran, but the word love is not one of them. And in the New Testament, one of the treasured ideas is that God is love. And therefore, we love in response. It's really a religion that is based upon law. As Jesus had this conflict with the Pharisees, there are a lot of similarities between how the Pharisees were looking at the law and how Muslims look at the law. It is God's will. Do it. See, there's no relationship like a child and a father, but it is an arbitrary, here it is. I've given it to you before, you have corrupted it before, and one more time. This is it, folks. This is it. It's through my prophet, Muhammad. And so that is the relationship that is created. The opposite of tawheed, then, would be shirk. So if there are two words you're going to remember, one will be tawheed, and the other will be shirk. Shirk is the opposite. So what does that mean? I say, Jesus is Son of God. Oh, that's shirk. If you commit shirk, it's not just an affront to a friend or a family member or another Muslim. It's apostasy. So when the Christian says, Jesus is the Son of God, Jesus was incarnated. They believe in the virgin birth, but not in the sense in which it is God being born in flesh. It is a human is born of a virgin, and he grew up to be a good prophet and true prophet and representative of Allah, but he's nothing more. But here, to say that Jesus is the Son of God, in other words, there is association of a partner with God, see? That's the worst sin that you can commit. Shirk. So what makes for a Christian is what makes for an infidel with a Muslim. So it's not very friendly toward alternative beliefs. Well, what applications and implications does Tawheed have for the Christian-Muslim relationship? We used to hear a lot about dialogue. Let's get together and dialogue. That word has now been superseded on television, you know. Let's have a conversation, right? You hear that on the news? Let's have a conversation about this, which I think is is a synonym for dialogue. Let's just get together and discuss it. Well, it's good for people to come together and discuss their differences. But if you push this to the point of assuming in comparative religion, comparative religion is a field or a discipline in education, which means you compare this with that. You may even find some contrast, but the underlying assumption is no one's right. Or you're as right as the other guy is right. There's no defining truth. Well, the Muslim does not buy that. The Muslim will never come to you as a Christian in your dialogue and say, okay, suppose then that we admit that Jesus is the Son of God. He'll never do it. He can't, because it violates the center of the faith. And if you're going to violate the center of the faith, you're going to commit shirk. Which means that in a Muslim arrangement, once a Muslim, always a Muslim, and if you say that you have given up on it and committed shirk, then as the representative of Allah, they have a responsibility to you, not just to leave you alone or tolerate you, but to deal with you. And depends upon wherever you are doing it. Let's just suppose a sheikh from Saudi Arabia were to say, I denounce Islam, and I have become a Christian, and I believe that Jesus is the Son of God. How long would he live? Till the end of the day, maybe?
Well, they do have a process.
A process, but it's not a drawn-out process, is it? What I'm trying to say is that within Islam, it is a strictness that is there because it is tied so closely to the central tenet of the faith. So Conversation, dialogue, yes, but don't expect compromise. Don't expect the Muslim to give anything in this. And if anybody does a compromise, it's the Christian, and then if the Christian does that, he's committed shirk as well. You know? So what effect does the Tawheed concept have on the character of Allah? Well, we've already noted that he can't have a son. And if he can't have a son, he can't come into the world. And if he can't come into the world, he can't die on a cross. And if he can't die on a cross, he can't be resurrected. If he can't be resurrected, there's no forgiveness of sins. Okay? Very simple. There, Tawheed has an effect on the character of Allah. Allah cannot do these things. Which brings up another subject. Why does a person need the crucifixion and the resurrection? Well, Islam, it doesn't. Because Islam is really a system of jurisprudence. It's not just a religion. It's a total system. That's the reason of oneness. Bringing everything together, all of the world and operating, as long as it operates under the will of Allah, as revealed through Muhammad, everything is peaceful and delightful, etc. As I say, the Middle East is kind of destroying that ideal. But the idea of Tawheed has a lot of effect on the character, as we see the character. So when we come down to why did Jesus die, then we understand that because man is a sinner and there is nothing man can do on his own to bring himself back to God, but in Islam you start out with man is not a sinner, that man is basically good, and that man is expected to keep the will of Allah. Keep the will. Now, here's Adam in the garden, and Adam takes the fruit and eats the fruit, and God comes to him and said, Adam, what have you done? Okay, you're familiar with the story from the biblical point of view. From the Quranic point of view, when God approaches Adam, what have you done? I forgot that you said not to eat of that particular fruit. You know, I got busy in the garden and did this, and God says, no big deal. Here is my revelation, here is my will, and when you take it, you're forgiven. So I just keep reminding you, Adam, and every Adam after that, that here is my will, till you come to Muhammad, and he said, now this is it, this is the final time I'm going to give you. But the result is, the response is, I will respond to Allah and to this act of forgetfulness by accepting and doing the will of Allah, and is taken care of. Now, there's one other caveat in that, is when you come to the end of life, Islam will say, in fact, in the Quran, every surah, chapter, but one, starts out with the idea that God is compassionate. Allah is compassionate. So what's the meaning there? Well, it's not the same as in Christianity where we'd say God is love. God has mercy. It's like when you get to the end of the road. You've done all of these commandments. You have been faithful to the end, to the extent that you can, because you're human and you have forgotten a lot of things that you ought to do. You get to the end and meet the judgment. So what's going to happen? You don't know. Haven't done enough. Did I do the right things? Did I pray enough? Did I go on the Hajj? How will Allah judge me? I don't know. We've had some sessions with people in the Middle East, and by the way, there are lots of folks who are Muslim in the Middle East who have converted to Christianity. We were in the Netherlands a few years back to a group of nearly 1,000. Most of them were converted Muslims, and I just started asking around, why did you convert? Why did you leave Islam? Because I thought in my own mind, sort of like the Messianic Jew, that you keep all the traditions and all of the trappings, and then you just add on belief that Jesus is the Son of God, and whether you keep Passover or not, you know, if you're Jewish and you keep Passover, fine, you know, Paul discussed that in the New Testament. So I thought in my own mind, that's the way the Muslims are, and maybe what we should do is we should keep Ramadan and keep some of these activities after they believe. But was I wrong? because almost, I don't know how many interviewed, but a number of them, and almost to the single one, no, we don't want to have anything to do with anything that reminds us of Islam. And so we began to ask, it, what is it that was attractive? What brought you over? And, well, we would rather have a live Savior than a dead prophet. Another was assurance. That the Christian has assurance in Christ that you meet God in the end, you're prepared to meet Him in the end, and you know with assurance about what's going to happen to you. And not like the Muslim comes to the end and he doesn't know at all. So he said that assurance was one of the major items. And so we need to recognize that a lot of Muslims are converting. And nowhere is this as plentiful as in Iran. We were in Iran on our 50th anniversary, and we just wanted to go there, the couple of us, and sense it and experience it and so on. And it was a most marvelous journey, and being able to ask questions and to kind of sense where people were was very good. And we found that down underneath, when you deal with the people level, that it's very different from what you hear from the news on the political level. And that's always the case, I suspect. But these folks are more in the searching mood. It's not to say everybody there is. It's a very secular nation, despite the fact that we think it's a very religious nation. But it's very secular in terms of the people. And people themselves are delightful. But there are a lot of conversions, and many of them pay the price. And in our school, we have a lot of Iranian students and have over time. Some of them have had to leave, and we know of some of them who are persecuted. They're called in by the prisoners. They're kicked out, lose their citizenship. There are a lot of things that can happen to them and do, but you've never seen the strength of faith as you see in persecuted lands. And where the screws are on very tight, it seems like it just sprouts faith. It's not as prominent in the Arab countries, though there is some good activity in Algeria these days. Of course, what is happening there is the scattering of folks, and a lot of Christians are being pushed out and they're leaving the country, and that's not good for the future. But it's a mixed bag. But there are a lot of conversions that are going on there. Let me see where we need to be with our timing. I'll just summarize some of these pretty quickly. Is it okay? That where the oneness of the Tawheed is, it really projects a more limited sense of God, although the Muslim would say that it is unlimited. It projects a God who is arbitrary at the end of time. He said, I'll take you, I'll take you. The compassion is really, I have compassion on the one individual that I have chosen, because nobody's worthy. So I am arbitrary in that. And that's not where we are in Christianity. In what way is a religion, Islam, a religion of peace? You will always hear, how many of you have heard somebody talking about Islam is a religion of peace? Raise your hand if you've heard that statement, religion of peace. Okay, you know what that means? They're at peace with Allah. Not peace with the enemy. You're the enemy. You believe in you've committed shirk. You believe Jesus is the Son of God. You're the enemy. Allah can have no peace with you. You see, we got accustomed to reading our Bibles, and the Bible says God is love. We were sinners when God approached us. We weren't righteous and He approached us. We were sinners. But in Islam, you're righteous when He approaches you. But if you're a sinner, He hates those who are against Him, and that is those who don't do Allah's will, that is those who are not Muslim. So it is a misrepresentation, intentional, I would suggest, on their part, to suggest we are a religion of peace. If you're a Muslim, you're at peace with Allah, and you ought to be at peace with one another, which they're not. But it doesn't mean what they suggest that it means. When you're making comparisons, how do you compare things? Do you compare the Quran with Jesus? Do you compare the Hadith with the Bible? Do you compare the Bible with the Quran? What do you do? Well, really, it's as the screen shows. It's not Bible and Quran. That's sort of a fundamental mistake that we make. We say, okay, open up the Bible, open up the Quran. That's not the way to look at them. The Quran is more Jesus. And this morning we will revisit that. Is in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. The Word became flesh. Jesus is the living Word of God, not written. Jesus is the Word, incarnated Word. Where in Islam you've got a written document, which are the recitations of the prophet. And there's where the comparison is. So our word is Jesus, and their word is the written document. The Bible and the Hadith would be more similar, the Hadith being the explanations of, sort of like the writings of the Apostle Paul, etc. Don't hold me down to this. This is not an exact equivalency. But what I'm just trying to get across is that the position of Jesus is so central to us as opposed to the Quran with the Muslim. A summary here of some of what we've been saying is Islam, again I say, is not a religion only. And here's where the difficulty comes with the American trying to relate freedom of religion to the Muslim faith. If Islam is only a religion, and what they do within the confines of the mosque is free in America, freedom of expression, you can say whatever you want to say, do whatever you want to do, and when you leave the mosque, you assimilate with the population, you're just a good American. If that were true, okay, that'd be one thing. But given the character of Islam, remember what we're talking about today is the central tenets of it, but given its character, Islam is by nature more than a religion because it covers economics, it covers ethics, it covers history, law, philosophy, politics, science, sociology, as well as the theological. So under a Muslim rule, Tom and Bonnie can tell us here that in Saudi Arabia there is no constitution. It is Sharia law. It is the Islamic way. And so down line, given Tawheed, given the nature of the religion, regardless of whether your neighbor is practicing or not, down the line, the leadership of it will sense the need to impose a total Islamic view on society. And that way it becomes anti-constitution. And that's the only way that you're going to resist it at the political level, because you cannot win by saying at the religious level, because there's freedom of religion in this country. But most people don't realize how extensive Sharia law really is. Sharia, that's the totality of Islamic law. Does not reveal the nature of God. It only tells you what He wants you to do. It is only Islam that chooses the middle road, as they say, that is concerned with spiritual matters and material life, and bases itself upon the foundation of primordial human nature. This is from the Islamic worldview. Man's action is toward God and in social surroundings. So the social surroundings are as important as what goes on in the mosque. And all actions are performed in the shadow of three basic principles: divine unity, philosophy, prophecy, and the last day. And we haven't talked about the last day, but there is something that's going to happen on the end. And depending on whether or not you're Sunni or Shia, it will change. I'm going to just stop at this point and give you an opportunity to raise some questions if you like. We have one here and then a second one.
I'm curious to try to, this has been very helpful, very enlightening. My question is, you were talking about how they do recognize Jesus as the prophet.
Yeah.
Our understanding of how we see Jesus is pretty much dependent upon how He's revealed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how do they accept Jesus as being a prophet of Allah, and yet the same document that reveals him reveals his nature?
Uh-huh. Excellent question. Can anybody answer that one? The question is, how can the Muslim have the documents like the Gospels? I'm rephrasing maybe. How can they have the Gospels and deny that Jesus? Well, the Gospels are fabricated by the Christians in order to distort the real message of Allah. And what Allah did when he came to Muhammad was to set things straight. So even though Christians and Jews are people of the book, their book is contaminated. So you just dismiss it in that fashion. Easy. So Jesus doesn't fit the oneness, doesn't fit the concept of Tawheed. If he doesn't fit the concept, rewrite the text. Okay? Tom had a question.
Now, one thing I wanted to mention, the individual Muslim, even when they come to this country, are evangelistic.
Yeah. His comment is that when Muslims come to this country, they're evangelistic. Muslims really are serious about their faith. They're serious about it in the way that they dress. That's the reason they dress the way they do. They're not ashamed. They claim, and this is part of a resurgency that's about 45, 50 years old, where there is a reclaiming of those values. If we had a time to do a history of Islam, we could get into that. But no, they're very dedicated to their faith. Very sincere, very sincere. Here, here, and here. If you did what?
Would you say that their view of shirk, that sin, is our Christian view of blasphemy?
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. And there are two things that are sacred, Allah and Muhammad. And you say anything against Allah, that's blasphemy, right? So if you say anything against what Allah has said in the Quran, the recitations to Muhammad, then that's blasphemy. Or if you condemn the prophet who was the instrument through whom Allah gave this revelation, that's blasphemy. And that's why there's all this excitement when someone does something about Muhammad's picture. And we had one here.
You said that they recognize and believe in the virgin birth.
Yes.
How do they reconcile?
Well, you can have a virgin birth, that is, Mary was a virgin, and have a birth without the birth being divine. Okay. Well, however that works, you know. Okay.
The main differences between
Shiites. Let's see. We're going to get to that a little bit more, but number one, you start out as a difference. There's a difference between who is the leader. That's where it started. Other differences existed on the information in the hadith, in the traditions, which ones are there. Another has to do with what is accepted as authority, whether or not you can consider beyond the hadith consensus of the scholars and the analogies that can be made in jurisprudence. And then there are some differences in terms of some of their rituals, etc. But enough differences so that the Shiite especially doesn't like the Sunni because he didn't accept Ali's son as the legitimate successor of Muhammad. And there are other changes there. Systematically they're the same, Tawheed, etc. And we had one in the back. That may do it. Only those that coincide with the Quran. If it's different from the Quran, throw it out. If it's the same as the Quran, you know, that's it. But whatever the Quran does not specifically, exclude.
Do they believe in his crucifixion and resurrection?
No. A couple of views on the crucifixion. There was somebody else who was actually crucified. Or that on the cross that Jesus was caught up somewhere else, either on the earth or into heaven or something of that sort. There are differences among them on that. But no, there could be no crucifixion. And a basic premise there is that prophets don't suffer. Okay, we've got to bring this to a conclusion quick.
likes of the world. If you take away, I'll take away from you the kingdom of heaven. It says that in every different denomination.
Yeah, so probably.
If we believe our way and they believe their way, how are either of us wrong? And if that were the case, wouldn't we all be wrong? Because we don't read.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's the reason why we have to be certain of our faith, and then we let God make the judgment in the end. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very, very much. We'll see you in a few minutes.